Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Okay, let us begin.
Hello, hello.
with an unusual encounter, which comes from this lady here.
I'm Susan Schaller, and where do you want me to start?
Her story starts, actually, it starts kind of abruptly.
I was indeed riding a bicycle to high school. And
bam!
A catering truck hit me.
Oh, ay, ay, ay.
And I was put in the hospital with a concussion. I was 17 years old. And the concussion was bad enough that it slowed my brain enough that I couldn't read. And so naturally I couldn't go to school.
Which sucked for her.
At 17, I was very much a nerd. And I was bored out of my mind.
So imagine Susan sitting there in the hospital. One of her friends.
A friend of mine who was just a little older and had graduated a semester before me suggested going to the nearby university and crashing classes.
Now, wait a second. Why would you go, if your brain was working slowly, why wouldn't you go swimming?
Well, I couldn't read, but I could listen and I could hear. And the person was saying that, oh, it's a lot better than high school.
And so one day she was at this college.
Just kind of wandering down a random hallway.
And I opened the first door on the left. That was the accident that changed my whole life, just picking that door.
At the front of the room, there was this older guy. He was thin, he was bald, and he was tracing shapes in the air with his hands.
It was as if there were pictures being painted in the air, and then they immediately disappeared. Then another picture appeared. I was mesmerized.
Uh-huh.
The professor was signing.
This class was actually one of the first classes to teach sign at a regular hearing university ever.
I had also walked into history but didn't know it.
Fast forward 5 years, Susan now is fluent in sign. She moves to Los Angeles. It's the late 1970s.
And I was snatched and put into interpreter training programs because at that time there were very, very few interpreters. And I found myself in a classroom.
In a community college.
In something called a reading skills class.
So she walks into the class, sees kids all over the classroom making big, excited gestures one to the other.
And at the door, I saw this man holding himself.
Kind of off by himself.
Making his own straitjacket.
She went over to the instructor and she pointed at the guy. She said, who's that guy over there? And the instructor said, he was born deaf. His uncle, he has this kind of insistent uncle who brings him here every day. We don't know exactly what to do with him, though.
And
what did this guy look like?
He was a beautiful, now I know. I don't know if I would have had that in my head at the time, but a beautiful-looking Mayan, you know, high cheekbones and black hair, black eyes.
And something about his eyes caught her attention.
He was studying mouths. And I walked up to him and said, hello, my name is Susan.
And this is where things start to get a little weird. He looks at her, and instead of signing his name, whatever it was,
he brings up his hands
and signs right back to her.
Hello, my name is Susan.
Susan, shakes her head and says, no, I'm Susan.
And he responds, no, I'm Susan.
Everything you said he tried to say?
Exactly. I call it visual echolalia.
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 Echolalia. And I remember thinking,
why is he doing this?
I mean, Susan, did he look like he had some kind of disability or condition?
He was intelligent. I wouldn't have been able to answer if you had asked me, how can you see intelligence? But you can actually see intelligence in people's eyes.
He was just missing something.
To copy me meant that he didn't really know what I was doing.
And that's when it occurred to her.
This man doesn't have language.
Wait, how old was this guy?
He was 27 years old.
And in all that time, no one had taught him sign language or anything?
Well, he didn't know he was deaf. He was born deaf. He didn't know there was sound.
Really?
27 years, no idea that there was sound. He could see the mouth moving, could see people responding. He thought we figured all the stuff out visually. And he thought, I must be stupid.
And so here's the question for our hour. This is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Words. What do words do for us?
Are they necessary?
Can you live without them?
Can you think without them?
Can you dream without them? Can you...
That's enough.
Can you swim without
them? No, that's enough.
No. Back to the story. So this man that Susan met, we don't actually know his real name, but when she wrote about him in her book, A Man Without Words, she called him Ildefonso.
There they are, sitting in the classroom. She's right there with him.
And of course, she's wondering,
what have you been doing for 27 years?
So she thinks, well, let me see if I can teach him some just basic sign language. In an interesting case, she takes out a book and makes the sign book.
But the sign for book, it looks like opening up a book. So he thought I was ordering him to open a book.
So he grabs the book and he opens it.
Because he thought I was asking him to do something. It was very difficult. If I gave him the sign for standing up, he thought I wanted him to stand up. And so I couldn't have a conversation with him. And it was the most frustrating thing I have ever done in my life.
Wait a second. How long did this go on for?
Well, weeks. It was weeks.
Wow.
Oftentimes, when we said goodbye or just left, we couldn't really say goodbye, I really believed that we wouldn't see each other again. And I was oftentimes very surprised when he would be sitting there at the table. And I think sometimes he looked surprised that I showed up.
But after a couple of weeks of him
constantly miming, copying me,
she had an idea.
Perhaps. It's just possible that if I died tomorrow, I would have had only one really, really good thought in my life. And this was it. I thought, I'm going to ignore him. I taught an invisible student. I stopped talking to him and I stopped having eye contact and I set up an empty chair.
And then she says she would hold up to this empty chair a picture of a cat.
And I was trying to explain to this invisible student that this creature, a cat, so I'd be miming a cat and petting a cat, and then I signed the sign for cat.
Then she would hop to the other seat, the invisible student's seat, and pretend to get it.
Oh, I know, with my facial expression. Oh, I get it.
So you're playing all the parts. You're both the teacher and the invisible student.
That's right. That's
wow.
Right. Doing all these crazy things, and he just watched me.
He stopped copying her, which was good.
But I do this over and over and over for days and days and days.
And she says he just didn't get it.
He looked bored a lot of times.
But one day, in the middle of one of these endless pretend student exercises,
something happened.
Out of the corner of her eye, she sees him shift his body.
And he looked, it's interesting how his body was upright, and he looked like something was about to happen. He looked around the room. This is a 27-year-old man, and he looks around the room as if he had just landed from Mars, and it was the first time he ever saw anything. Something was about to happen.
His eyes grew wider, she says, and then wider. And then
he slaps his hands on the table. Oh, everything has a name. And he looks at me in this demanding way, and I sign table. And he points to the door, and I sign door, and he points to the clock, and he points to me, and I sign Susan. And then he started crying. He just collapsed, and he started crying. What is it that happens in human beings when we get symbols and we start trading symbols? It changes our thinking. It changes our ideas of it's no longer the thing, a table that we eat on, but there's something about the symbol table that makes the table look different. Ildefonso was in love. He was in love. It's like everything has a name. And for the first couple weeks, he had this list of names that kept growing and growing.
Paper, eagle, clock, green.
I kept copying words for him.
Cat.
And
I was like, he's a hat. Cardinal.
Gave him the sign for door.
Door.
Then I would
door.
Write D-O-O-R.
Serpent. See that?
And he
strawberries.
Folded this paper.
Paper?
As if it was
treasure.
Treasure. And he would pull it out every day and he would
lion.
Carefully unfold it.
Tiger.
And he would add to it.
Orange juice.
Apple.
DJ.
Thinking.
Leaf.
Horse.
Leaf.
Idea.
Add to it.
Lamb.
Blue.
Table.
Bird.
Wall.
Dove.
Name.
Add to it.
Pig.
Left.
Front.
Right.
Cows.
Hawk.
Left.
Of the blue wall.
Octopus.
Symbol.
Treasure.
Bird.
Eggs.
Orange.
Ham.
Hippopotamus.
What is it that happens in human beings when we get symbols?
Symbols.
Symbols. You know, once you have begun to put words onto things, you can look at a thing, say this symbolic sound, table, and the person opposite you knows that you're talking about.
But she seems to be saying something deeper, though, that like when you get the word for table, that suddenly the table, like this table right here, looks different. Like it somehow the word changes the world in some fundamental way. Now, I don't know if that's true about the table thing, but consider what happens when you put words together. Okay, when you link them up.
Good, okay.
So I want to tell you about this experiment.
Fantastic.
That I learned about from a fellow I talk to sometimes, Charles.
I'm Charles Ferniehoe. I'm a psychologist at Durham University in the UK.
Ferniehoe.
And when I first read about this experiment in Charles's book.
Called 1,000 Days of Wonder.
It blew my mind out of my nose and onto the book. It was a little messy.
I never want to be with you in a library.
It takes a little journey to get to the mind-blowing part, mm-hmm. but luckily. And I'll let Charles explain it. The whole thing happens in a room.
Yeah, you're put into this room, which is coloured completely white. The walls are white, the ceiling's white, the floor's white.
So it's all white?
All white.
Everything's white. And you can tell where you are to the extent that some of the walls are longer than others. So on your left
hand side. Are we in a rectangle, is what you're describing?
Yeah, it's a rectangular room.
Are you with me so far?
I'm with you so far.
Okay, just to give you a sense of the baseline conditions here, imagine you are a rat in this room. Okay.
And somebody comes along and hides an object in one corner of the room.
What?
It can be anything. I mean, for rats, you'd use food.
Like a biscuit or something?
Yeah.
They hide a biscuit in one of the four corners.
In one corner.
You see it.
Okay.
But before you can get to it, they pick you up by your tail, spin you around a bunch of times.
So you don't know where you are. You don't know which direction you're facing it. And then they say, right, now go and find the biscuit.
So if you do this with a rat, what will happen is it'll say, all right, let me go find the biscuit. And it will
go to one corner, which looks right. But of course, the room also looks like that if you turn around through 180 degrees and face exactly the opposite direction.
Because it's a rectangle.
So they get it right about 50% of the time.
Because corners of rectangles, two of them are identical.
Yeah.
All right, so should we get on with this? Because I'm well aware of rectangles.
I just needed to get that out of the way, because
okay.
The cool part is coming up.
I
now.
Hope so,
so. What the experimenters did next mm-hmm. is they took one of the four white walls, mm-hmm. and they turned it blue. So imagine this scenario. You're in this room. You've got these four white walls, or rather, three white walls.
One of them is blue.
Right. Yeah. Well, now you're not confused anymore. You can relate everything to the blue wall. You can be like, oh, the corner with the biscuit was left of the blue wall, or right of the blue wall.
Well, they get to the left.
You now have the blue wall as a
navigational clue.
Yes.
That makes sense. You know, we would all be able to do that. That's not going to be difficult for us.
All right. We got to the good part yet?
Yeah, it's coming. It's coming.
Turns out, though.
The rats, he says.
They're still scoring 50-50.
What?
It's as if they can't take any notice of the blue wall.
Even with the blue wall, they're only finding the biscuit 50% of the time.
Wait a second. Can a rat see color?
Yeah. Rats can do color.
They do color pretty well.
Okay.
They also do left, right, just fine.
But what they can't do is connect those two bits of information together.
In other words, they can only... Well, they can do left. That they can do. They can do blue... They do blue, but they're both separate. They can't do left of blue.
These different kinds of knowledge can't talk to each other.
How does anyone know that? I mean, what rats have been interviewed for this survey?
What? They infer this based on studying the rats.
So the rat doesn't have what? Doesn't have the neurons? Doesn't have the... What doesn't he doesn't have?
The rat can't do it. That's all that you need to know. And I'm going to make it weirder right now. Neither can some humans.
I spent the first 10 or 15 years of my scientific life studying creatures who don't talk yet.
That's Elizabeth Spelke. She's a psychologist at Harvard. quite famous for her work with...
Kai.
As you can hear.
Babies, and I was interested in their abilities in relation to abilities of other animals.
Come on, get up, we're going to go into the monkey room.
So she began the baby development lab, which is filled with toys, and on any given day, five or six really tiny kids.
She's 6 months.
Oh, who's this?
I'm a big kid.
Yeah.
Toddlers, too.
How old are you?
3.5.
Big time.
So, at a certain point, Elizabeth Spelke decided to build a version of the white room in this lab because she wondered, if rats have so much trouble connecting the idea of left to blue, what about
surely
baby humans?
A self-respecting 18-month-old human child will succeed in putting them together.
But
no.
What we find is that children behave just like the rats.
Just like the rats.
Just like the rats.
Really?
Okay. Just like the rats, or almost yeah. Just like the rats?
Well, we don't test them with food, we don't test them with digging, so in superficial ways, superficial features of the studies are different.
But she says kids, like the rats, cannot connect the idea of left to the idea of blue. They just can't do it, and they can't do it at
one.
They can't do it at
two.
They can't do it at three.
Four, five.
And we find that those children start performing like adults around 6 years of age.
Now I'm interested.
Good.
Something happens at the ripe old age of six.
It is shockingly late, right?
Yeah.
Well, something happens at the age of six that suddenly allows the kid to connect concepts like left to concepts like blue. And the question is what? What happens?
Several people have suggested that one candidate for a process that's doing this is language.
What do you mean it's a language? Kids are talking, certainly at 3, 4, 5, and 6, they're talking like a... too much.
But what they haven't yet started to use is spatial language, and particularly the kinds of spatial language that adults would use in this situation to describe what they're doing.
And somewhere around the age of six, they start to use phrases like
left of the blue wall.
And those aren't just words that come out of the child's mouth. Liz thinks that inside the child's brain, what that phrase does
is link these concepts together.
Clink. And at that moment,
left of the blue wall.
The child leaves the rats behind.
I can't. You should. That was that. She doesn't think that kids have that.
Well, let me put it to you a different way.
Okay.
And this is my best understanding of what she thinks. Her basic idea is that a child's brain begins as a series of islands. And on one island, way over here in the brain, you've got, say, color. You can call that the blue island.
Blue.
That's the part of you that perceives the color blue. Way on the other side of the brain, you've got the part of you that perceives spatial stuff, like left.
Left.
Maybe on a third, objects like wall.
Wall.
These things are there from the beginning, but they're separate. Then you get the words left, blue, wall. And then the child, for the first time, comes upon the phrase left
of the blue wall.
And in that moment, all the islands come together. It is literally the phrase itself, she says, that creates that internal connection.
Everybody's always talked about how language is this incredible tool for communication. It allows us to exchange information with other people so much more richly and effectively than other animals can. But language also seems to me to serve as a mechanism of communication between different systems within a single mind.
There you go.
Wouldn't it be just as possible, just listen to me here, that the kid's brain is developing some new connections and what follows then follows from the changes in the brain?
So the words are like an after.
Yeah, after.
After fact?
After effect.
Yeah, well, that's no. The experimenters actually accounted for that.
Well, what the experimenters did next is that they thought, okay, if language is adding this extra element, let's try and knock it out.
How would you do that? Would you like shoot something into their brain that kills the language part or something?
It's a much simpler way of doing it and a much more humane thing you can do.
What we did is put adults in the room.
And then she says she gave them an iPod.
They've got headphones on.
Playing through those headphones is someone talking.
Yep.
And their job while they're in the room is to just repeat what the person is saying.
Continuously listening to speech and repeating it the whole time they were in there.
It's actually a really hard thing to do. If you've ever tried shadowing somebody speaking, I mean, if you try...
Can we try it? You go, and I'll shadow you.
Okay, Jan.
Okay,
Jan.
I'm gonna start
gonna
start speaking now, and
right
I want
back
to
me,
say it
exactly
right back to you,
as I
exactly
say
as I. Oh and my God! Starting to hurt my head. That's really hard, actually.
It is hard, yeah. And what that does is it knocks out your capacity to use language for yourself.
Basically, battering the words out of the adult's head.
Why are they doing this again?
Well, they want to see, like, if you blast the words out of somebody's head,
what would happen?
Can they find the biscuit? Will they be able to form that simple thought left of the blue wall, or will they be like the rats who can't? And?
And we actually got very dramatic results.
They went right back to being like the rats.
Wow.
Yeah.
But Charles, what I'm wondering is if language allows you to construct a thought that is so basic as the biscuit is left of the blue wall, what is thought without language?
Well, I don't think it's very much at all.
What do you mean?
I'm going to put it in a different way, and this involves making quite a controversial statement. I don't think very young children do think.
Like think, period? Was there a period at the end of that sentence?
I don't think they think in the way that I want to call thinking, which is a bit of a cheat, but let me say what I mean by thinking.
Okay.
If you reflect on your own experience, if you think about what's going on inside your head as you're just walking to work or sitting on a subway train, much of what's going on in your head at that point is actually verbal. I want to suggest that the central thread of all that is actually language. It's a stream of inner speech. That's what most of us think of as thinking.
Well, on the other hand, what I'm most aware of when I'm reflecting is the stuff that I can't put into words. I think that he's exaggerating the role of language here. Yes.
This all really hinges on how you would define thinking.
Yes.
And Liz would say, take a musician. Like, I'll give you my example, Bill Evans. Here is a form of thought that carries you through a definite sequence of phrases, feelings, emotions, changes. And there are no words.
But there's something that we get access to when we gain a full natural language that we can use not only to communicate with other people, but with ourselves.
We have two Shapiros. Test, testing, test, 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 test.
Language is fundamentally a combinatorial system.
As we head up the steps, what is this? This is a
we're going to Columbia
University.
See, we'd gotten interested in the last thing that Liz Belge said about language being a combinatorial thing.
System.
Right, and that led us to Columbia.
Here's the deal.
7 minutes late, which is...
You have words now. You have words in combination now. Now you can play with the combinations.
And that, as you'll hear...
Just us three then, right?
It's just us three.
Good.
Opens up... A kind of infinity.
Head to foot now is he total gules, hardly tricked with blood of fathers, mothers, daughters, sons, baked in and pasted with the parching streets that lend a tyrannous and damned delight to their vile murders. This is Shakespeare. When I sat in middle school and they gave a Shakespeare, roasted in wrath and fire, and thus orsized with coagulate gore, I was completely confused and I felt stupid.
Can you just introduce yourself?
This is
James Shapiro. I'm.
He is a Shakespeare scholar, obviously.
At Columbia University, where I've taught for 25 years.
And one reason he says that Shakespeare can be confusing is that often Shakespeare behaved not so much like a writer, but more like a...
Like a chemist combining elements. He's taking words and he's shoving them together, smashing them together, if you will,
and
combining...
Sometimes these word experiments, they didn't go so well.
There's the prince's orgulous. Orgulous has not stuck. And that just goes in, that goes in the...
What does it mean?
You got me. I mean, I should know. I thought.
But look what he did just by adding a little prefix, un.
There's so many words that we're now familiar with. Unnerved. You know, we all know what that means. But nobody had heard unnerved, unaware, uncomfortable.
He made up uncomfortable?
He was the first to use that word.
On a stage.
Right. Unearthly. Unhand. Undress, uneducated,
ungoverned,
unmitigated, unpublished, something that's near and dear to me.
Unpublished.
Unsolicited, unswayed, unclogged, unappeased, unchanging, unreal.
He made up Unreal.
And he's the first to use it in print or on stage.
Would an audience at that time have understood what the un prefix meant?
Not you know, real?
I think it takes you a split second. Unreal. To kind of put that on the real.
But then suddenly you've got this new concept that there's something real, but not.
He's taking words that ordinarily are not stuck together. Things like madcap, ladybird, shoving them together. Eye drops to achieve a kind of atomic power. Eyesore, eyeball.
He did eyeball?
Yes.
That's hard to understand how that someone could think of that. But it seems like it's always been there.
If you ask me what his greatest gift is, he's putting them together into phrases that have stuck in our heads. So truth will out.
Truth will out.
What's done is done. I could go on and on.
He wants you to go on and on.
Crack of doom. My favorite, dead as a doornail. A dish fit for the gods. Dog will have his day. Faint-hearted, fool's paradise. Forever and a day, foregone conclusion. The game is afoot. The game is up. Greek to me, in a pickle. In my heart of hearts. In my mind's eye. Kill with kindness. Believe it or not, knock, knock, who's there?
Oh!
Laugh your stuff into stitches. Love is blind. What the dickens? All's well that ends well. Something wicked this way comes. And a sorry sight.
Wow.
That's a champion.
That's pretty fantastic.
How did he create phrases that stick in the mind that make it seem as if they always existed?
Yeah, how? You're taking out a book.
Thinking of a passage here.
That is maybe the biggest book I've ever seen.
Nonsense.
It was at least 3,000 pages.
Shakespeare doesn't write a lot about process, but there are one or two places where he does. In a poem called Lucrece, in which a woman is raped, Lucrece's rape, and she has to write a letter to her husband explaining what happened to her, and she's struggling to find the words in which to do this, and finally she picks up the pen, and it goes. She prepares to write, first hovering o'er the paper with her quill. Conceit and grief and eager combat fight. What wit sets down is blotted straight with will, this too curious good, this blunt and ill, much like a press of people at a door, throng her inventions, which shall go before. I'll read that couplet again. Much like a press of people at a door, throng her inventions, which shall go before. If you want to extrapolate from this something that Shakespeare might have himself experienced, you have a situation which all these ideas are pressing. It's like a throng of them. Who's getting through that doorway first?
It's a little bit maybe like that experience you might have at a nightmare New York club, where you've got like thousands of people in a tiny space, and everyone's trying to push their way out, and they're like, God, let me through the door, get out of my way, and it's just like this
throng of images, of sounds, conceits, thoughts, ideas, and they are providing the pressure that's needed to produce words.
You know what?
What?
This makes sense to me, this interpretation. Now, not just for Shakespeare, maybe for anybody. Certainly the guy we met at the beginning, Ildefonso.
Who just learned words for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, as you move through the world, if you're sensitive at all and you're observant, you're going to get filled up with all of these things which you have to express but can't until you get those words. Then, boom, the door opens.
And thanks to James Shapiro, professor at Columbia University, whose newest book is Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare?
Also, thanks to our kids, Louisa Krasnow, Stella Story, and Isaiah Harrison. And also thanks to the moms that brought them in, Therese Tripoli, Carrie Donahue, and Patricia Starek.
Hello, this is Susan Schaller. Radiolab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Charles Fernie Ho. Radiolab is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR.